When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Okay, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. Now, I'm greatly honoured this week to have David Vivas, lecturer in early modern history at Bangor University, and also author of The Great Defiance, which is kind of one of a number of books that kind of re-examine and re-explore the legacy of the British Empire. If you're here in the UK listening, this has been in terms of kind of popular historiography a contentious and key issue for at least a decade, I would say. The Black Lives Matter movement, the plans to tear down statues of Cecil Rhodes and all, and this kind of moment we're in means that not only are there a sheaf of new, very reactionary titles about weren't pith helmets and bayonets a fabulous thing, but also a range of new books, Empire Land and things like that, looking at the legacy of empire in a far, far more critical way. Now, the Great Defiance, which I'm reading at the moment, is an excellent kind of re-examination of looking at the resistance to the British Empire. And wherever you are in the debate, whether you see the empire as being a kind of a sort of benign progressive force, whether you see it as being oppressive, or whether you exist somewhere in the middle, if we leave out the stories of the people who fought and resisted empire, then we're not really looking at a whole picture. But anyway, I'm telling David's a thesis here. But I'd like to, anyway, welcome David, and you can tell us the kind of the core arguments of the Great Defiance.
Yeah, well, I mean, you get Carrot, you've explained it a lot better than I have over the past year or so. Well, listen, thanks for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to come and talk about it. Yeah, so it's I mean, the Great Defiance, I mean, maybe its subtitle helps a little bit, says how the world took on the British Empire. And so all it does, I think, in its simplicity, and when I pitched the book, it was a really simple pitch. It's just that we have lots of histories of the British Empire as this kind of centrifugal force, you know, emanating out from Europe and conquering these regions, often quite spectacularly, beginning in the sort of late 16th century, by the end of the 18th century, having gobbled up most, you know, the subcontinent of India and inroads into the coasts of Africa, most of coastal North America, the Caribbean island. You know, it's this kind of spectacular expansion, and it sounds like a story of, you know, some books of reason, a relentless rise, you know, shifting the geopolitical landscape of the world by the end of the early modern period. And if you believe some historians, then ushering a new modernity of which we are still feeling the effects of today. You know, the contemporary landscape is very much a product of the British Empire in the 19th and 20th century. Now, that's a fantastic narrative. But for me, my research over the past almost 15 years now, in which I tend to study the non-European societies and political entities that encountered the British during this period, is that these were very kind of complex and powerful societies and economies and militaries, and I saw a expansion that was far more checkered, far more uneven, advancing in some parts of the world, retreating in others, abandoning other parts, compromising for centuries into. And so I thought, hold on, this is less a kind of quick, inevitable rise of British expansion. It's one that was often frustrated and had to accommodate the people it encountered in what I found quite surprising ways. And so suddenly it became a far, I think, more a richer story for having two sides. And I think that if you cast the people that the British eventually conquer in this as just sort of the objects of British conquest, and then you strip them, you make them passive, and you strip them of. And you make them reactive to British advances. And so I thought, well, what does a history look? What will a history look like that can accommodate their perspective? And suddenly you see, that some of these colonial conquests took generations to achieve, and in some cases over a century. And so I think that made the kind of pendulum of power swing back from the British to a lot of these societies that they attempted to conquer, and some that they never could. And so for me, that was, as you put it quite eloquently earlier, a history of the British Empire, in which it's not just the British that the agents of change. It's a variety of non-European and indigenous people. So I brought them into the story, and hopefully I've just given another aspect of that history that we haven't had too much of so far.
So, are there moments? I mean, if you look at perhaps Ireland or India as two examples, when you look at first English colonialism and then British colonialism in Ireland and then British colonialism in India, the thing that you get, the kind of the picture that you get of Ireland or India, is the result of this kind of almost negotiated sort of encounter between colonizer and colonized. If it were, some other kind of imperial story, one that was sort of kind of outrightly genocidal from the beginning, of which there have been, it then it's not quite like that. But I get the sense that where the expansion of empire meets resistance, something kind of happens there, and it shapes the outcome. Is that kind of, I'm speaking in broad generalizations, but is that sort of what we mean here?
Yeah, no, I think that's generally the framework that I certainly find. And, I'm not the only one. Let me say that there are, tons of scholars before me and at the moment looking at these kind of complicated, I mean, often in the Atlantic context, we call it the middle ground, where Europeans meet indigenous entities and cultures and have to sort of find their way and adapt and often accommodate them in the Indian Ocean context. We may think of it more as a negotiation between the world superpowers. You mentioned India, so the Mughal Empire, not just the Mughal Empire. There's a whole host of empires and sultanates that Britain has to sort of adapt to rather than steamroll over because it can't. Even in Ireland. So what I wanted to do is I wanted to start the book with Ireland because we often don't start histories of the British Empire with Ireland. Ireland is under Henry VIII created into a kingdom of which the English monarchs rule, and therefore it's often just subsumed into domestic English history. Any wars that take place, there are uprisings against the monarchy to be crushed. But no, that's that. That's an Anglo-centric perspective. Ireland is the first colony of the British Empire, and it remains so all the way through. Even up into beyond the Cromwellian reconquest of Ireland, it's treated differently from Scotland, for example. And so, and even there, we assume that, that was a conquest centuries in the making, and going all the way back to Anglo-Norman times in the 12th century. And by the time we get to the Elizabethan conquest that we're more familiar with at the turn of the 17th century, it's really a product of the failure to steamroll over Ireland. Actually, a lot of the early colonists, when they get there, are are seduced by Gaelic-Irish culture, and their power bases are Anglo-Irish, not English. And they're, and so there's an ability where the English crown, by the time of the Tudor period with Henry VII, has to essentially rule through old English and Irish lords, and has to recruit them as allies, and has to reward them with patronage, and they become so powerful, in fact, that they're quite capable of intervening in English politics. And the various rebellions against, for example, Henry VII have Irish support. Yes, before the kind of mass colonization of English and Scottish Protestants, it is very much a, backed up by military force and including atrocity. Still, there is an aspect of the English having to accommodate local Irish interests as much as possible. And, for much of this period, it's only part of Ireland where the English writ runs, and for large parts of it, they're running it in through networks of Irish lords and their clients. So yeah, I think that's a good way to describe it.
And if you fast forward into the Stuart era, if you were to, around 1640, to if you were Charles the First and wishing the English had never become involved in Ireland, if you think of a kind of a counterfactual where Ireland isn't in Ireland sort of was never colonized, in a 1640 scenario, quite possibly Charles the First would never have experienced a civil war. There's this kind of crisis moment, and that suggests that with colonization of Ireland actually becomes almost like a kind of like a net liability to the English crown eventually.
Yeah, but I don't even think we have to. And actually, that is a hypothetical I put to my students. And one of the assessments I have, I run a module on the Three Kingdoms, the War of the Three Kingdoms, and it's that without the Irish and Scottish uprisings, there would not have been an English rebellion in 1642. So I think there are important dimensions and context for that. But actually, even by the time the final independent Irish lords have been crushed at the end of the 9 Years' War, that ends in 1603, the English feel that the conquest of Ireland has become like a millstone around their neck. The Irish conquest of Ireland under the Tudors, and at the beginning of the Stuart period, cost more in men and money than either the war with the superpower of Spain or the intervention in the Netherlands, which much of our attention is showing. It cost £2 million. It cost perhaps up to 100,000 casualties. It's a gigantic conquest. And by the end of it, rather than converting the Irish to Protestantism, to rather than them having accepted English law and custom, rather than speaking English, in fact, what they're left with is this massive military occupation of Ireland, one that faces constant rebellion after 1603. And it's not what, and this is what my book tries to do, is that what we end up with at the end of the early modern period, and you look at these maps of the British Empire and they look impressive, this imperial pink here and here. Actually, it's often it's a map, I think, of compromise. And it's not often what the British had hoped to achieve. It's really the result of English and later British ambition and agenda meeting indigenous or non-European power. And the result is this compromise. So you've got a 500 plus conquest of Ireland that ends in really, in some sense, failure, because no one in England wants a multi-million pound military occupation. One that has really, by the time Elizabeth dies, brought the English state to the point of collapse, certainly by bankruptcy. And that's only avoided by extreme measures. And the fact that when James takes the throne, he becomes quite lenient. And wants to settle the two. So I think that even in conquest, that there is a degree of failure through that compromise.
There are countless different kind of debates about the nature of the British Empire, and you essentially almost from kind of high school level onwards, there's this discussion of was it the Empire of Trade, was it the Empire of Conquest, and it depends when you ask. But obviously, when you talk about Ireland, the whole point of having an empire, no matter who you are, is to not make the dominant country poorer. That's really kind of pay, the kind of rookie error. And so did the British, do you think, was there some kind of was it some kind of learning moment? Did the British Empire seek in subsequent decades and centuries to try to do things as profitably as possible.
I think it's working on two levels here, and I think that if we kind of break it down, if we break colonialism or imperialism down to two different levels, you've got the sort of the role of the state or the crown in the earlier period, and its aims and ambitions and the impact that colonization has on them. And then you've got a second level of it's the individual colonists and officials involved in these schemes of conquest and colonialism. And so I think that we can't see it sort of as an English or British thing overall. And even within that, you've got things like companies and corporations that are involved. And some historians see the kind of British Empire more as like this matrix or this kind of quilt, this patchwork of different colonial entities operating. But I think that, you know, places like Ireland, the English state is certainly worse off for its conquest. And the great beneficiaries of the defeat of the Irish lords are the private colonists and colonial officials and corporations. And so while the English state is, you know, on the verge of bankruptcy, there are people like Sir Walter Raleigh who, you know, has been able to carve out sort of millions of acres of Irish plantations that he benefits from. He uses that the wealth that he extracts from Ireland to fund further colonization schemes in North America. So the settlement of what we would call, you know, Carolinas or Roanoke back then, and funds expeditions to discover you know, various sources of gold in South America, and none of that pans out, of course. And there are many people that benefit privately, like the City of London, from the plantations it establishes in places like Londonderry in Northern Ireland, that are able to then use that to invest in the East India Company. And early East India Company investment draws from these various sort of plantations. Even the East India Company sets up, you know, foundries in Ireland, and you know, purchases Irish livestock that's confiscated from the Gaelic Irish, Catholic Irish, and is now run by Protestant settlers. So I think on the private or in terms of individual colonists, there is a lot of a benefit, and they're the main beneficiaries, and it helps to then propel the English colonization elsewhere. The English or British state rarely is the beneficiary of these conquests, and often is the loser in some respects. And you could argue, obviously, the true losers are those who are dispossessed and who are defeated. But in terms of who benefits, yeah, it's rarely the state itself and all the individuals involved. And that perhaps reflects, you know, how the state worked in the early modern period.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The next thing I think to focus on is this idea of resistance. Obviously, you know, the kind of the way in which we have traditionally understood the British Empire, you know, the kind of the histories of the British Empire were being written in the heyday of the British Empire. There were people writing, saying, asking questions like, how did things work out so well, and what is it that's so special about the people on this little island? And I guess is it fair to say that you can only really write things, you know, histories like the Great Defiance, where we are historically now, you know, in a post-imperial age? Or were people asking these kinds of questions? Were Victorians asking these kinds of questions?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. I think that's a difficult one. I mean, when I did the research for this, I was struck by the fact that lots of contemporaries did realize that what they were doing to the indigenous people of the Caribbean, for example, or the indigenous Americans in places like Virginia and elsewhere were horrific and were wrong. You know, people say, you know, you can't write a history, you know, adopting kind of our present values. Well, things like war pillaging and, you know, conquest and the displacement of entitlement has always been viewed as wrong. It's just when you're benefiting from at the time, you attempt to justify it. And that's what a lot of European countries did, engaging in the trading of enslaved people and the dispossession of indigenous people. They attempt to justify it. And you build an entire sort of imperial ideology, eventually, in Britain's example, you know, the white man's burden. But there are dissenting voices that you find in quite surprising and unexpected ways. But what you don't get, because it doesn't fit the mainstream kind of ideology or narrative at that point, you don't get kind of complete histories, rarely get complete histories that can provide you with a kind of comprehensive understanding of the empire that are critical in that period. So where you can find individual dissenting voices and criticisms of colonialism, contemporary, you know, at the time it's happening, rarely the histories that are being sponsored, approved and written So I think to get a more comprehensive narrative or analysis of the expansion of the British Empire, you do kind of have to wait. This is what, you know, post-colonial scholarship has done. This is what decolonizing scholarship is doing. It's removing us as far as possible from that framework, that cultural literary framework that has ensure that most of the histories we write about the British Empire are sympathetic because they are Eurocentric or Anglocentric. And I think that in this global age, especially of academia, you know, it's a real global discipline. We can, you know, draw on the perspectives and the findings of colleagues in the global South, colleagues of colour. And that will essentially help to decenter our perspective. You know, at the end of the day, you know, as a white man from Britain writing this, I can only shift that view. So if I have to rely on the fantastic scholarship being done elsewhere, and a lot of these places are former colonies of the British Empire, and so I think yes we need to be as removed as we are now, but even then there's only a certain amount of we could do in the global white north, really. And there's also a fine line, you know, between using or promoting and integrating the research done by colleagues outside of Europe and also not exploiting their labor to use in our British histories of the rest of the world. And so that was a challenge of the book, and whether I've done that successfully or not, I don't know. But I don't think that should necessarily stop us trying as much as possible to decolonize our histories of empire, which sounds like a complete contradiction, but unless we're going to push as much as this idea of objectivity, I think we have to do that. Otherwise it will always be a British history.
And at the moment, I mean, listeners to this podcast will know that I've talked with a number of scholars in the last couple of months on similar topics to this. At the moment, obviously, we're in this kind of vociferous kind of cultural battle for the ownership of, it's a very crude way of putting it, but essentially for the ownership of this narrative around the British Empire and slavery and colonialism. Why do you think we are in this moment now, in terms of the intensity of this debate?
I think it's one of those questions that I certainly have, you know, been consumed by in the past few years, and I've spoken to lots of people and I've written things and distilled my ideas, but even every time it's asked anew, I still think, oh God, that's such a, I feel like I'm so involved in it. It's kind of hard at some point to pull yourself out and gain perspective. So what I find really interesting, I have said this before, I think in some ways it's slightly coincidental, because what you find in the production, so, you know, we've been, scholarship on the British Empire and imperialism, with the advent of global history in the past 20 years, has been going in this direction anyway, including and accommodating the perspectives of the colonized as well as the colonizer. That's naturally been happening in academic scholarship certainly in the global north, you know, places like Europe and North America for the past 20 years. Happening elsewhere in places like India, you know, since post-colonial scholarship in the 70s and 80s. And thankfully, you know, it's been Indian historians that have taken the lead in understanding the British Empire in places like India. Now, what always happens is there's a lag between what academics are doing in their little silos and campuses for that to filter out into more popular, accessible histories. And I think one of the interesting things that's happening at the moment is more academics are moving into publishing popular histories, narrative histories for not just university presses where maybe 100 students and academics will read a book, but, you know, where thousands will then go to Waterstones and be able to access academic research. That's what I try to do. And so there's a kind of natural lag. So what you find with new histories of the British Empire, or revisionist, as you might call them, which I hope my own is, which other historians, you know, Charlotte Riley's fantastic book that's come out the moment. Satnam Sangira has done a great book, Empire Land, that's kind of trying to acknowledge that, you know, that we are still living in this kind of age of empire in which, you know, much of our understanding is shaped by the superiority of Europe and the legacy of the British Empire, and histories of empire as well, which try and acknowledge that and try and rewrite it. Is that they're just happening at a time when, you know, things like you mentioned the Black Lives Matter movement, the toppling of Edward Colston's statue. And so a lot of the books that have come out, my book, Charlotte's book, were already, you know, underway. They were already being written and being researched. You know, this book and, you know, these take 5 to 10 years to research and write. And so and as I was finishing my book and all this was unfolding, the conversation was about empire was shifting. I had to kind of accommodate that and address that in my introduction and elsewhere. And so and so in a way it looks like a kind of concerted effort, like academics are jumping on the contemporary shifts and changes and capitalizing from that. And, you know, whether there is, I don't know, but I can say that a lot of the books that have come out in the past 2 years that are certain position in this conversation of condemning and suggesting of woke and, you know, you know, blah blah blah, just the product of academic scholarship gradually filtering out into more accessible forms. So in a way I think it's incidental, and then so you get this kind of contemporary shift and this conversation about statues and our imperial past, you know, and the formation of reactionary groups that are combating that, like History Reclaimed and that sort of thing, and then that happening at a time, and so it looks like it's a public contentious issue that's brewing in country, when actually I think, and certainly from revisionists like myself, this is just part of the research that we've been doing and have been doing it for 10-20 years. And then the second part of that answer, if I could just take another minute or so, is that the history has become so contentious because it's one of those disciplines that has real, and all disciplines have real societal impact, but it speaks to our sense of identity, our heritage, our culture. And so any attempt to shift our understanding, or hopefully to revise our understanding about our past and therefore our identity and our culture around race and even religion and international relations, is naturally going to spark a backlash and be a contentious, divisive issue. And I think that academics have just been caught on the front line of that, mostly because we are now kind of entering that public space and producing these books for a wider audience. And so I think, as I said, I think we've just been caught up in that. But if you write a book saying, oh, actually, maybe we were the baddies, according to the people that we conquered, which is a natural assumption, you know, victims of conquest will cast you as the baddies, that then speaks to people that are not even historically literate, that are not even, you know, that perhaps didn't even go to university and have had no kind of participation in the academic debates around this, will naturally feel like that they should participate because it questions their identity and their understanding of who they are, religion. And so if you look back and think, well, obviously this is going to be an explosive issue. And, you know, in a way, that great, that's what history should do. It should challenge and have some kind of impact. And I'm glad I work and write and research in an area that is sparking this massive conversation. That it is spilling over into a kind of, I think, a rather nasty conversation in which there are groups who are being victimized and attacked because of it. Yeah. Now it's folded into this whole conversation around wokeness and race. I think that's the great pity. But I think the fact that people are talking about the British Empire, I can never be disappointed about that, even if not everyone shares my perspective.
The Zoom clock is running down. I think a final thought is sort of encapsulated in what you said there, in that the thing I always try to do on this podcast is to recomplicate history, which might sound like a kind of a bad thing to do, but it's I think it's really, really important. And I think the Great Defiance is like this kind of recomplication of this story you get told in school. Actually, in fairness to a lot of school colleagues that I have, the teaching on the British Empire has leapt ahead in recent years, and then wonders have happened. But I still think that by not being able to hear about resistance, and by seeing this kind of, you know, version of history as the colonizers, the savages, and the victims, to be crudely, we miss one heck of a trick. And so I think that the value of the Great Defiance, and I think this is why I would urge my listeners to purchase it. As I always say, from an independent retailer, Amazon has more and far too much money already. It engage in that recomplication. So that's my plug for the book.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
David, we must finish in a moment, but I was wondering, might there be an opportunity to continue this conversation at some point in the future? There's a heck of a lot more to be said about the early modern kind of expansion of the British Empire.
Absolutely. I love it. I'd love to be able to talk maybe a little bit more depth about some of those less known people and communities that, you know, came under attack and sustained quite a successful intergenerational centuries-long resistance. That will be great to bring those to your audience.
Fab. Well, it's been too brief already, but I will drop you a line and we'll arrange a thing.
Super. Thank you, Nick. Okay. That's brilliant.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.